From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Gary Giddens joins us this week. He's the foremost authority on jazz. He was the voice of Ken Burns' jazz film series. Gary Giddens has written several books, including the first volume of A Life of Bing Crosby, a biography of Louis Armstrong, and lots of others. His new book is a great collection of film reviews. It's called Warning Shadows, Home Alone with Classic Cinema. Gary Giddens, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, it's been a while since Pocket Full of Dreams, the first half of your life with Bing Crosby. So are you working on Volume 2?
That's what I'm working on, yes. And I'm closing in.
Yes. When might we see it?
Well, it's scheduled for late 2012.
I guess we can hang on.
I hope so.
Well, before we get to Warning Shadows, if you don't mind, we could talk about Bing a little bit.
Sure.
Because I'm interested, I love Crosby, and I'm interested in that second half of his life. I've been so anxious for the book. You know, Bing Crosby was so accomplished, and he was so great, and yet he was, like, pathologically self-effacing, if you ever hear any interviews with him. Do you believe him when he says that he doesn't think of himself as a singer or an artist or an actor?
That's a very interesting point. I do. I think that I believe him because I'm very much aware of the nature of his Catholicism and his Irish Catholic upbringing and his genuine belief that if you stick your head up, somebody will lop it off. He really did not like to boast. On the other hand, he was so much a craftsman. I mean, he had so much pride in his work that he knew he was good. He always knew that. And of course, his whole life was getting feedback to that point. But I think, especially after the war, Bing took the war very much to heart. I think this is going to surprise people. And one of the things that held me up was, like, I got a couple of years ago, Mrs. Crosby allowed me into the house and basically allowed me to go through tens of thousands of papers. And the find that most astonished me was Bing's letters to servicemen and to their widows and mothers after they'd been killed. A lot of them wrote letters to Bing about their sons and husbands, and he did not delegate these letters. These are in his hand, and what he would do is he would write the letters in longhand, and then his secretary would type them up, or he would dictate them into a dictaphone belt. And I've listened to some of the belts, and they're astonishing too. I mean, there's not a single pause or or let me start over. And what's remarkable about these letters is the tone that he's able to find different for each one, and the amount of effort he puts into it. And I think, you know, unlike Hope, who was able to, you know, dedicate the rest of his life to some degree to entertaining the troops, it took a lot out of him, but his commitment was such that I don't think he was ever going to, you know, boast about his success as a showman when he took to heart how many young people had given their lives. A lot of people don't realize this, but at the end of the war, Yank Magazine, when it folded right after the troops came back, in their last issue had a poll of who had done the most for GI morale. And Crosby won in a landslide. He won over FDR, over Churchill, over Eisenhower, over Bob Hope, because they were really very conscious of how much he had given to the war effort. He insisted, for example, that Decca send thousands of his recordings to troop ships all over the world. And
by saying that he insisted, did that mean that he absorbed the cost of those records?
Of course, absolutely. And, you know, then he went to London in France. He went about as far to the front at the Ardennes as it was possible to go. In fact, he went farther and got into a little trouble with General Patton. There's a famous story where Patton said he finally came back in a jeep that evening after Patton had a, you know, breakdown over where he was. And when he came back, Patton yelled at him, "Do you realize you were in German territory?" And Crosby said, "Well, we had it this morning." that was a very important part of his life. And the real payoff, and this again is something I find totally fascinating, the most successful years of his entire career. A lot of people assume it was during the war or during the 30s, but it wasn't. It was 1946 to 1949, and I think that was made that was possible by the returning servicemen, who those were also the years where Sinatra's career completely nosedived, because he had really not made that commitment. And after that, Sinatra was remade and rock and roll came, and by the mid-1950s, Bing was, had become sort of a monument, but was not working as ardently as he had. But boy, those years, 1946, three of the top five grossing movies of the year were Crosby films. I mean, that's unheard of.
Also in the 1950s, I guess he was kind of in the middle of his life, he made a lot of great recordings. There have recently been some new releases of some of his 50s recordings, including this great Mosaic set that you wrote the notes for.
Isn't that amazing? I have to say, that one stunned me, because nobody had heard all of those recordings. And the quality of them, the sound quality, and the mood he's in, just, playing with that quartet.
Were those mostly one takes? You could just.
I think so. They appear to have been. If there were more takes, they didn't survive. But they have that quality. And from what I've been told by Rosemary, who did some of the sessions after when they started to do a syndicated radio show, he was pretty much a one take guy by then. Bing was funny that way. He was always the first guy in the studio, and he always came prepared. A lot of people who said, it was amazing. He never missed his marks, but he didn't seem to need to rehearse and all of that. Well, that's not quite true. He rehearsed at home. He made sure he knew everything when he got on the set. There's a story I love about that. You remember the movie, Riding High, Frank Capra film?
Sure, it's a remake of Broadway Bill.
Exactly. Horse Track. So there's a scene in it where they do a song called Sunshine Cake. And because of the complexity of the way Capra set up the scene, he decided to record it live rather than lip-syncing from a recording. So while they're doing this number, the great Clarence Muse has to pretend he's playing a guitar, and Bing has to play spoons. So Bing, on his own dime, unknown to everybody else on the film, goes out and hires like the best spoons player on the planet from some carnival or something, and comes onto the set a masterful spoons player. I mean, that's really him. Whereas Clarence Muse, they couldn't use close-ups of his fingers on the guitar because he didn't know how to play the guitar. So they had to use an insert of a professional guitarist.
But Bing mastered the spoons.
But Bing actually came as though, it was no big deal at all.
He really was an amazing performer. And I've heard stories that he would show up, say, for a radio program, and they'd say, he's going to be a guest on the Durante Show. And they say, we've written this song for you, Bing. And he'd glance at it and say, okay, fine, and go out and do it. Is that...
Well, he had an astonishing memory. Everybody who worked with him musically says that he only had to hear a song once. In truth, sometimes he would play it too. He'd go to a restaurant where they had jukebox if he was going to cover a tune that was already, out there on the popular. And he would put in a few nickels, listen to it two or three times, and he would know it. He would know this is a guy who could not write music, could not read music, but he had such a great ear, and he would know the changes, he would know the tune. Remember the great scene in Here Comes the Bride when he and Jane Wyman do In the Cool, Cool, Cool of the Evening?
Wonderful song.
It's an amazing performance. And she, when I interviewed her, she was just amazed at how he didn't miss a step. He just had everything completely nailed. And because of his expertise in that respect, he was very generous to other performers. You'll hear stories of complaining about he could be cool and cold and remote and aloof, and he was certainly tough on the kids in the first family. But you never hear anything against him from people he worked with. I interviewed about 300 people, and virtually all the actors and musicians I spoke to were just in awe of working with him.
I think of all the top popular vocalists of the 20th century, he recorded more duets than any other.
He did. That he loved duets. And in fact, even Gary Crosby said, you know, everybody wanted to do duets with him because he would make you look good. He would do the harmony part. He would give you the star part, and he would support you so well. And his time was just infallible, which is why jazz musicians adored him. I mean, even in the 40s when he became, you know, the White Christmas guy and was singing mostly pop tunes, often very sentimental tunes. I remember once, years ago when I just started on Volume 1, and I ran into the great saxophonist Jimmy Heath, and he said, "What are you doing?" And I said, I'm going to write a book about Bing Crosby. And he, "Oh, man, I want to read that." And I said, "Really, you dig Bing?" And he said, "Where do you think we got the songs from?" And he said, he was the only guy on the air at that time, of the white mainstream guys, who had time. So that no matter what he sang, you could identify with him because he had that beat, you know? I mean, Nat Cole had it, some other people had it, but most of the ballad singers, the mainstreamers, you know, Perry Como had no beat whatsoever.
Right. But although he imitated the kind of the Crosby sound in his
right.
Yeah. I saw Perry Como once in concert, and he said, "Bing Crosby gave me a lot of advice over the years, most of it bad. But there was one piece of advice that I took to heart," and then he played Bing singing "Learn to Croon."
Well, I interviewed him too, and he was very astute in terms of his own abilities. He said, basically, "I come out of Bing and Russ Colombo."
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Colombo, who was probably the first successful Bing imitator when he first started, was basically a ballad singer who could not swing. He could not sing jazz tunes. And I think Perry realized that that was his forte. He was a lovely ballad singer. He had a great voice. Bing liked him a lot, and they did some wonderful duets on television. But, you know, Crosby was unusual in the fact that he really came out of that jazz world. He adored Armstrong. He, you know, Artie Shaw's line about him being the first hip white guy born in the United States, is a reference to the fact that he was the first guy to really understand how revolutionary Armstrong was, and the great lesson that if you had time, that could indemnify you against a lot of vices, a lot of bad songs.
Well, you know, there's the kind of legend or the popular myth of Crosby is that he abandoned jazz and, turned to pop and kind of sold out or that kind of thing.
Yeah, well, when I hear that, I say four words, Bing with a beat.
Right, that wonderful 1956 or something.
RCA recording, I think it's 57 actually, mm-hmm. And it's one of the great albums he made. And now we have the Mosaic records,
which really proves it, huh?
I think so. Yeah, I mean, he never abandoned it. The thing that I fault Crosby for most as an artist is that modesty when it comes to the point where he will listen to Jack Capp, he will listen to record producers who tell him what to do.
Mm-hmm.
The one place where he would not do that is on radio. And on radio, he never stopped being a jazz singer. He's always singing all these great songs on his radio show. But when it came to going into the studio, basically, unless there was a song he really wanted to do, or doing a favor for a friend who wrote a tune, he was plugging, of course, the songs from his movies, he would do the kinds of songs that the producers thought he should do. And, we all wish that he had made several more albums like Bing with a Beat. But in that period, musicians of his generation were having a hard time getting recorded at all. I mean, even Nat Cole, who's, you know, to me is like one of the all-time genius performers, at that point was very rarely even sitting at the piano, one of the great pianists in jazz history. At that point, he'd become pretty much a ballad singer.
I was just going to say, there is the Hey Jude, Hey Bing album.
Oh, my God. There's one funny story about that album.
Yeah.
I always think that's an album I use when I teach as an example of how insane the industry can be. Because who was going to buy that record? Bing's fans did not want to hear him sing Hey Jude. Beatles fans sure. It was a record guaranteed to sell to nobody. But
I bought it.
Yeah, me too. Jimmy Bowen, who produced it, told me that while they were doing one of the tunes, in the control room they kept hearing this jingling, this staticky sound, and they could not figure out what it was. And they would go through the studio, play back the tapes, they couldn't catch it. And they would start doing it again, and then they would hear it again. And it turned out that while Bing was singing, he had change in his pocket, and he was juggling the change with his hand nervously, which I think tells you a lot about what he thought about those songs. So finally, Jimmy walked in there and said, "Bing, you have to empty your pockets." So he took out this big, you know, pile of change, and they put it on the table, and then he was able to record them.
Although there is a clip that I've seen of him on the Hollywood Palace where he's got Diana Ross and Jose Feliciano and some other contemporary singers, and they're all taking turns doing, you know, the classic hits of the day. And Bing holds his own with those guys.
Well, you know, he tried, but, you know, I know which program you mean with Feliciano, which I think becomes a little hysterical there for a while, but they're doing Light My Fire and
That. Yeah.
You know, he did have a problem in the latter part of his career, which was that he had signed a contract with Decca which prohibited him from re-recording for any other label records he had made for Decca. And when you consider how many hundreds of, you know, standard tunes he'd recorded, that wiped, he's the only performer that I've ever heard of who is legally enjoined from re-recording his hits, records he was most associated with.
Had he done concerts, he could have played them in concert, but he couldn't.
Absolutely in concert. But and on radio.
He could have done them on the radio then.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
But although he couldn't use them, like he had to get special permission to use one of the, I forget which tune it was, as the theme for the CBS radio stuff that we were talking about earlier that came out on Mosaic.
Right.
And then he ended up going back to a theme that he had done before the Decca contract. But if you look at the contents there, there are no Decca covers. So I'm guessing that he was enjoined from using them on that as well.
You know, I've recently listened to some outtakes of Frank Sinatra in his prime recording the song The Summer Wind, and it was a revelation because I always think of Sinatra's phrasing as just coming naturally to him. But when you listen to him do these takes of The Summer Wind, which is so beautifully phrased in its final recording on Reprise, he didn't have it when he first comes into the studio. He's not even close.
Yeah, well, Sinatra was an incredible craftsman. This is a guy who used to submerge himself underwater to hold his breath so that he could sing nine-bar phrases without having to breathe. And sometimes, I have the rolling tape from the I Remember Tommy album, and you can see that a few numbers he never completely got through. They had to do splicing jobs. Sometimes he goes through a number and he's, you know, breathtaking, and sometimes he just doesn't quite have it.
I want to ask you about Crosby then. Did he work out his phrasing, or did it just come naturally, or how did that happen with him?
I think once he figured out how he wanted to do the song, I think it came very quickly. He also was, you know, Les Paul told me that he was at a session, he was playing guitar on a session, and Bing was introducing a tune by Meredith Wilson, who, this is before The Music Man, so Meredith Wilson was just another song plugger trying to get known. And at the end of the performance, Bing hit a bad note. And Meredith, you know, was afraid to talk to Bing, but he ran over to Les Paul and said, you know, that was terrible the way he phrased the end of it, and can't you get him to do another one? And so Les Paul walked over to Bing and said, you know, Meredith's a little upset about the end. You want to do another take? And Bing said, oh, that's all right. Let them see that I'm human. So, you know, and there are other recordings. The one with Lionel Hampton where they do On the Sunny Side of the Street. Bing hit some very bad notes. I mean, a lot of people wonder how they could have ever released it. And my feeling is he was so loved when Hampton did on that record that he thought nobody would even notice that he missed a couple of high notes. He wasn't that vain about that. But usually, you know, also a lot of the songs he was doing by that period, by the 1940s, he was so over-recorded. He was in the studio almost every day. If he wasn't actually formally making records, he was doing V-discs, or he was on the radio, or he was making guest appearances. I mean, for a guy who never performed in public between, 1931 and 1976, you know, he was out there working a lot. I remember when he came to the Eros Theater in 76, and I said to my mother that Bing had not performed live before a paying audience in 4 decades. And she said, oh, that's impossible. Bing was everywhere. And I said, think about it. Yeah. Did you ever see him? And, you know, Sinatra was a guy who really did play joints,
the
clubs, Paramount saloons,
Theater and all that stuff.
Yeah, concerts.
You don't see, Crosby never did those kind of concert tours after ever, I guess, right? After 1931 or something?
That's it. That's it. The only time he did it was benefits. He did a million benefits, and for the troops. He did all those victory tour performances where he really, I mean, if you look at any of the newsreels, he just gives his all. And one of the things I love about him also is he never, when he performed for those servicemen, he never wore that wig,
right,
what he called the scalped oily. He never had that kind of Hollywood vanity. In my first volume, in the first book, there's a photograph I used, even though it probably should have been in volume two, at a party in Spain where Errol Flynn kisses him on the top of his bald head, because Bing was the only guy in the business who had the guts to go out au naturel. Usually wore a hat,
right,
but he really, you know, whereas I interviewed his wig maker, who also did John Wayne and Bogart. He said to me, you know, John Wayne would have rather have been shot dead on the street than be seen without his toupee.
Now, I heard a story, and I don't know, it might be apocryphal, but I heard that Charlton Heston was appearing on television in a drama in which he was supposed to be bald, but rather than take off his toupee, he put on a bald head wig over his toupee.
That's hilarious. It's hard to believe, but it's hilarious.
Well, in your new book, Warning Shadows,
yeah,
Home Alone with Classic Cinema, you discuss some of Crosby's films, and you also discuss the films of Al Jolson and Frank Sinatra. You shocked me by calling Sinatra's From Here to Eternity performance ordinary. But so, do you think a great singer is logically a good actor?
I will think of how, you know, it hasn't been that frequent that it's happened. There have been a few instances. I mean, certainly Sinatra, who I think was incredible in the 1950s. I think I probably underrate his Maggio, but I'm so in awe of what he did in the other two films, The Preminger, Man with the Golden Arm.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, even I don't like the way they censored Pal Joey, but God, could there be any better Joey ever? And Guys and Dolls, he's incredible.
And Bing and High Society, we love him.
High Society, Some Came Running. I mean, he was a natural. Doris Day was a natural. But there haven't been many. I mean, most of the, a lot of the pop stars anyway, who they tried to make stars at the same time that they succeeded with Crosby, you know, fell badly. I mean, Russ Colombo did a bunch of films. They're hard to sit through. Kate Smith made one film, never appeared before a camera again.
She had a body for radio.
I'm sorry?
I say she had a body for radio.
Yeah, right. And, you know, Elvis was a natural, obviously, but think of all the other guys they tried to make stars out of, like Fabian and, you know, Frankie Avalon, these guys, Bobby Rydell, you know, these guys weren't actors. But there's a few who come along and you just, they're just amazing. The thing about Sinatra that's so, I don't know, disappointing, almost tragic, I think, is that after he really came all the way back from, you know, the terrible years of the late 40s and early 50s when he could barely get arrested and he was treated like dirt at Columbia Records, and then he wins the Academy Award, and then 56 he makes, you know, Songs for Swingin' Lovers and all those great films. After that, after about 1961-2, I think ending really with The Manchurian Candidate, he just stopped taking acting seriously. And all the stories you hear is that he would do one take and he would walk off the set. I heard stories on High Society that he would be late, he wouldn't know his marks, he wouldn't know his lines. Crosby had to actually, Crosby was deputized by the rest of the cast and the director to talk to him, and because he was the only one they thought who had the clout. And after that, they said Frank behaved perfectly. But the same year, they did the Edsel Show. I don't know if your listeners know about that, but this was the first really important television hour that Crosby did. And his guests, this was to promote Ford's Edsel, which was not a successful automobile. His guests were Sinatra, Louis Armstrong, and Rosemary Clooney.
Mm-hmm.
It was a hell of a program. And now it's, I think it's already come out on DVD.
Yeah, just recently they put out a bunch of the specials, which included that one.
Well, Rosemary told me that Frank, you know, you couldn't get him to come to rehearsal. He'd walk in, he'd be the only one who did not know the lines, did not know the order. I mean, he was fast and good enough that you wouldn't know it watching it.
Yeah.
But apparently he, you know, I think this is not unusual to Sinatra, but a lot of performers, especially from his kind of background, and this seems to have been partly true of Brando as well, they think that there's something unmanly about being an actor and being paid all those millions, or a singer, and that they have to prove themselves manly by being tough guys.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Sinatra really, you can see that his work just becomes, it's so phoned in a lot of the movies he made in the 70s.
Spencer Tracy, I think, had that same attitude about being an actor.
That's right. That's right. I have no talent. I just remember the words and don't bump into the furniture.
Right.
Bull.
But Frank Capra, in his book, The Name Above the Title, he talks about working with Frank and says that Frank Sinatra was a one-take actor because he was best in his first take, and that he worked with Keenan Wynn in that picture, I think, A Hole in the Head, I guess it is, and he had Keenan Wynn sometimes, if there was a second take, he'd have Keenan Wynn say, "What?" You know, just to kind of get Sinatra to repeat himself and make it fresh if they had to do more than one take.
Well, yeah, there are performers like that. I learned a very good lesson when I started writing. I was attending a record session. A friend of mine was the producer, and it was Zoot Sims and Al Cohn, the two great tenor saxophonists who had made a million records together in the 50s and 60s, and they hadn't played together in almost a decade, and this was sort of a reunion album. And Al Cohn is a guy who was at his best on his first take, and even though they were great friends and played together for a million years, Zoot was a guy who was best on the third or fourth take. And the first tune they did, Al played a killing solo, and Zoot was sort of, you know, nothing. So they said, "Let's do another take." Well, by the time they got to the fifth take, Al is depleted, and Zoot comes in like a train roaring out of a tunnel.
Hmm.
So, you know, part of it's psychological, because there is a sort of competitive thing, but part of it is also that some people, they get there, they've got the excitement, the adrenaline going, and that first take is everything, and then after it, they're not trained like British actors who come out of the theater to repeat everything, to repeat every gesture, every line, that once you have it perfect, you can keep doing it and keep enjoying doing it. That's really, and if you don't come out of that tradition, it can just be extremely tedious. And if you're a big enough star and you have the clout, you can use it. You can just say, "Sorry, I'm not doing it again." And Sinatra would do that.
We're talking with Gary Giddens, and his new book is a book of wonderful film criticism called Warning Shadows. Yeah, you know, I think Bing Crosby made some great films in the second half of his career. I particularly like a TV movie he made called Dr. Cook's Garden.
Right, when I tell people that Bing played a serial killer, they're like, "Yeah, right." You
know? And of course, you know, and maybe our listeners know from my interview with William Link a few weeks ago, that Crosby was considered for the role of Columbo, and I think he would have made an interesting Columbo. I was also thinking because Thomas Mitchell had played Columbo on the stage,
uh-huh.
And Thomas Mitchell played the Doctor in the original Stagecoach, and Bing Crosby played the Doctor in the remake of Stagecoach.
Yeah, that's a great performance, I think. It's funny, I asked Gordon Douglas, who was the director of that Stagecoach, what it was like to remake a John Ford film.
Yeah.
And I cannot, I don't know what the language issues are, but if the seven words of George Carlin still abide, I cannot quote what he said to me. But basically it was, "Are you out of your mind? No one can remake a John Ford film. All we did is tell the same story."
Yeah.
Which I thought was a great line.
I think there's some good performances. Yeah, Bing is good. And
Margaret is good.
Yeah. There's some good performances in it. Not as great, of course, as the original, but, you know, so what? What are some other later Crosby films that you like? I like A Little Boy Lost.
Lost is very good. That's a film where he really, it was while he was making that film that he found out his wife was dying. They were shooting in France, and there's a scene where he's waiting at a train station. He had just read the telegram, and the director, George Seton, was so overwhelmed by how powerful the scene was, he didn't think Bing would let him use it. But, you know, he was very professional. He really could, he would really let it show. I think his performance in Country Girl is amazing. I mean, those close-ups of him, so much goes on in those close-ups. I don't think anybody anticipated that he could reach those kinds of levels. But I was told by a couple of actors who were studying in New York at the time that film came out. Now remember, The Country Girl came out at the same time as On the Waterfront. And those were the two performances that everybody in class was talking about, Brando's and Crosby's. And Brando's was the ultimate Brando performance, but they expected nothing less. Crosby came as an astonishment to a lot of people.
It was a far cry from Father O'Malley, certainly.
A far cry. And, I mean, he plays a broken-down alcoholic. I saw the production on Broadway a couple of years ago with Morgan Freeman, who's one of the great actors in the world. But what he could not do, and what apparently even, I forget his name now, I think it was Paul Kelly, who played it in the original, could not do, is be completely demoralized, drunk, incompetent, whiny, all of those terrible things off the stage, and then mount the stage and then suddenly turn into the greatest performer in the world. And Crosby is the only performer who maybe who ever played the part, because he is a musical entertainer, was able to do that. I mean, the opening scene where he's auditioning, you think, whoa, you know, it's not even the greatest song in the world. It's Harold Arlen and Ira Gershwin, but it's not their best work, and Bing is just killing. And then he walks off the stage, and it begins with his shoulders. His whole body just completely sags and falls apart. And
he brings the history of Bing Crosby to the role.
He does. Remember that first film he made, a film that I've been trying to get somebody to reissue on DVD for 10 years now, The Big Broadcast, which I think is a great movie, plays an alcoholic in that.
Right.
And it's a powerful performance. It's funny, but it's also sort of terrifying at times. I mean, there's actually a scene where he and Stuart Irwin try to commit suicide.
Yeah. Well, he's a very giving, honest actor. Talking about what you were saying before about all the letters he wrote to servicemen, how did he get this reputation of the hollow man or all these things?
Well, a couple of things happened. First of all, people love to look for feet of clay. I mean, that's just an American characteristic. Maybe it's not just American. But this book, The Hollow Man, came out. It's a sleazy piece of work. I reread sections of it recently. It's totally not researched. It's based on a few interviews they did, and basically they pick and choose the quotes, and they write it. The whole thing is written in this tone of pretended sorrow, that we always adored him and loved him, and then we started to look into him and found out that he's this monstrous figure. And the theme that runs through the book is he betrays everyone. You know, and I followed the same footsteps they did. I interviewed everyone, and I didn't get that betrayal at all. I mean, even Gary Crosby was defensive about it, and he's the one who really nailed his father in his book, Going My Own Way. Now, most people, everybody has heard of that book, but very few people have read it.
Yeah.
And if you read it, you find out that it's not quite what its reputation would lead you
to
believe.
It's not Mommy Dearest. So.
It's really about Gary. And what the publisher did, though, which was really unfair, and which Gary tells me he did not realize until the published book arrived in the mail, is that they basically took out every really bad story he told throughout the whole narrative, every, you know, beating he ever got, which, you know, spanking, whatever it was, and front-loaded it into the first few pages, so that the first few pages leave a terrible impression. You can hardly get past them. But if you read the book closely, you'll see that over and over again, Gary will say something like, Pop took us to the session, and they were going to do a recorded duet, or he was going to be a guest on the radio or in the movie, and I really screwed up, and I knew he was going to kill me when we got home, but he didn't. I mean, you note how many times he says, I knew this was going to happen, but it didn't. And I have 9 hours of Gary on tape. I took him through that book, and I'd say, well, tell me about this, and he'd say, oh, man, I don't remember. I'd say, but Gary, it's in your book. This is what destroyed your father's reputation. And he'd say, yeah, but I was drinking. I said, but it's in the book. You weren't drinking when you did the book. And he said, well, if it's there, it must be true, but I don't remember. So then he started, taking back certain things. Now, I'm not defending Bing here, because Bing grew up with corporal punishment. He was routinely spanked by his mother. He thought it was a good thing. There's nothing in Call Me Lucky, in Gary's book, that's more damning than what Bing says about himself in Call Me Lucky,
yeah.
When he boasts about his kids will never forget the feeling of this leather strap, his belt. But by the mid-1950s, he knew he had made a terrible mistake. And he talks about it in many interviews, his biggest regret. And, you know, he really tried to bring those boys back from the brink. And he, you know, he got a second chance. And you talk to the three kids from the second family, they don't know what Gary's talking about. You know, Bing was very attentive to them. You know, he became a different man. But I think part of the problem with the Frisville boys, especially during the war, is that he was never home. They were raised, and Dixie was alcoholic. She was something of a recluse by then. They were raised by a housekeeper, very strict. She did a lot of the spanking. And Bing would come home and try to compensate for his absences by, you know, delivering all of these incredible rules. And, you know, I mean, Gary missed a curfew one night, and they canceled his 18th birthday party. Now, interestingly enough, that's probably the worst story I ever heard, but it's not in Gary's book.
Hmm.
And the person who told it to me said, you know, that really happened, and I think that was too painful for Gary to deal with. A lot of the things in the book really aren't that big a deal because, you know, I mean, I cannot imagine spanking a child. My daughter would have slugged me if I even looked like I was going to do that. But, you know, the truth is this was not that rare then.
No.
And he may have overdone it. I think, I have no doubt in my mind that he did. I think any kind of spanking is overdoing it.
But I
don't think
school.
He thought of himself as a bad guy at the time.
Yeah, I got spanked in school when I was in junior high school.
Really?
Yeah, they gave us a swat, and I told my mom they swatted me. She goes, well, I'm sure you deserved it.
You mean a teacher?
Yeah, the attendance officer.
My God, if a teacher had done that to me, my father would have come in and killed him. My father didn't mind, you know, occasionally. Even my father, you know, he would raise his hand like he didn't know what to do with me, but they never actually hit me.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I had been tardy to math class, you know, like 13 times or something, so I got this SWAT. And I tell you, I was never tardy again. I just ditched math after that.
Well, I don't know. I think there are better ways, but anyway, it you know, also we have to remember that there were four boys, and the others all, you know, denied much. I mean, Philip and Gary never spoke again after that book came out. Never spoke ever. In fact, when I interviewed Gary, I had to promise him that I would not talk to Philip. And I did not talk to Philip until after Gary died, and then I called Philip, and we spent quite a bit of time on the phone. And, you know, he just reminisced about how great his childhood was, going all to these Pittsburgh Pirates games and football games and meeting all these people, and how his father set them up in show business. And it was like, you know, really, did you live in the same world as Gary? But Gary did get the brunt. There's no question. Bing saw a lot of himself in Gary. What I find, because I have a lot of letters between him and the kids, what I find much more painful for me than the question of the corporal punishment is the verbal abuse that Gary alone of the four seemed to have to endure. I mean, it drove Bing crazy that he gained weight. He would call him chubby. And Gary just, you know, who could stand that coming from your own parent? And Bing just didn't get that.
So it's interesting when you watch Bing Crosby in the movies, especially those movies we were just talking about, where he really kind of delves into his own shortcomings as a person.
Well, I mean, they're there, but you know, on the other hand, you know, he worked with a lot of child actors. They thought he was, you know, Santa Claus come to life. I mean, because again, they knew him as fellow performers. I mean, Donald O'Connor absolutely worshipped the ground he walked on. He was 12 years old when they did Sinew Sinners, the first of their two films.
Right.
And then,
mm-hmm.
And then as an adult, they made Anything Goes in 1956. But when they did Sinew Sinners, this was Donald's first film. He was 12. There was a scene where he's riding on a horse. It's a long, long scene with a single tracking shot. And Bing is leading the horse and Donald's on the horse. And they're talking. They're having this very dramatic conversation. And it's all in one take. And they get to the end of the take and Donald screws up a line. And he said, oh, I was so upset with myself. I mean, this whole shot had been perfect. And Bing said, what are you worrying about? That's the way it happens. You know, it didn't care at all, and then it happened again. And you hear this all the time, and Bing was just... Ray Walston told me I mean, Ray Walston was, you know, by the time he went into the movies, he'd already been a big star on Broadway at South Pacific and Damn Yankees. And he was really trying to do a series. He wanted to have a reputation as a dramatic actor, which he never really got. But his one chance was a not good movie that he did with Bing called Say One for Me. And he said to me, Bing was the most generous actor I've ever worked with. He said, before my big scene, I'm a drunk, I'm making this big confession to Father Bing, he's a priest again in this film. And he said, I was very nervous about it. I thought this is the scene that's going to either make or break my performance. And I'm doing it with Crosby, who's so natural, so relaxed. And Crosby could see I was nervous, and he said, what are you worrying about? And so Ray started to tell him, and he said, look, we're sitting at the scene is at a bar. The camera's going to be shooting over my shoulder. I'm not going to move a muscle. You just talk to me. And he did. And Ray said, almost every actor that you work with finds some way to try to steal the scene, even if it's wiggling an ear, but not Bing. He said, if it wasn't for him, I don't think I could have gotten through it.
We're talking with Gary Giddens, and his new book is called Warning Shadows, Home Alone with Classic Cinema. And he's also written books on Charlie Parker and lots of things on jazz and so forth. Gary Giddens, you also, in your book, talk about film acting. I think it's in your article about Boris Karloff. But you talk about film acting as being kind of in the hands of the director.
Mm-hmm.
So, can you make anybody a decent actor, and can you make any?
You can make almost anybody better than they might otherwise be. If you know, it's like Duke Ellington once said that you have to know a guy's poker playing habits before you can write music for him. And Duke hired a lot of eccentric musicians who did not have the virtuosity that some others did, but they all could do something that nobody else could do, and he'd find out what that was. That's what he would hire him for, and then he'd write, you know, a concerto or a piece of music that would bring out those qualities. Like Cat Anderson, you know, was famous for his glorious high notes, not very inventive in the middle register, so Duke always wrote things that brought that out. And it's very similar. When you cast a film, it's like putting together the guys in an orchestra. You've already done a lot of your work simply by choosing the actors, and you know what they're good at and what they're not good at, and you edit around their strengths. Again, this was a lesson I learned when I was in high school, because Paul Newman, who had made his career originally on Broadway, had not been back in a while, and had become a huge movie star with movies like The Hustler and Hud and Hombre. He was a big, big star. So it was a big deal when he went back to Broadway. And I thought he was great, you know, and I went to see this show, I think, I can't remember, A New Kind of Love, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought he was really awful in it. And there was something, it had been so long since he'd been on the stage that he just seemed, you know, the way you, like when you don't know what to do with your hands, or he just wasn't selling the part. But then you go back and look at the movie, and they know when he's got that great smile, he's got those incredible facial expressions. They know exactly how to get what kind of posture in a particular moment. So it's a different kind of art. On the other hand, you look at Alec Guinness, amazing film actor, and I got to see him. I think the last stage thing he ever did was A Walk in the Woods. And he was playing opposite Edward Herman, who's not only a very good actor, but is about twice the size of Alec Guinness. And you could, Edward Herman disappeared. I mean, you couldn't take your eyes off Guinness, and Guinness didn't do anything. The way Crosby doesn't do anything in certain scenes. If you're that still, if you're that sure of yourself, you don't want to miss what they're going to do with their eyes or the slightest moment. It's an incredible ability that actors who are trained on the stage can usually go back and do that, as well as the kind of film acting where somebody else is going to decide which part of your body you're going to see in which scene.
You have a great article in Warning Shadows about Al Jolson and about the jazz singer. I've heard it said that Jolson was one of the greatest entertainers of all time, and I'm a fan, but I think that today's audiences really can't, I don't think there's any electronic medium that really captures the appeal of Jolson. But what do you think of Jolson as an actor, as a film performer?
Well, there's no question that he has a lot of power, and I think he was too big for film, because at first he was simply trying to do his stage persona on camera, which, you know, really didn't work. If you look at some of his rehearsal things, you get a better sense of what he was like. The big problem with Jolson, I think, that is so hard to get past is the blackface. I remember when my daughter was a kid, I was watching some of those things. They had just come out on Laserdisc, and she just, like most kids do, she fell completely in love with the sound of his voice, but she made me fast forward to all the songs he did in blackface, because there's something really, it's not just offensive racially, but there's just something now, you know, we just don't know what, we don't even understand what that's about anymore, of why an actor would make himself look so bizarre with, you know, a black shiny face, big white lips, the curly wig, the whole bit, which was so much a showbiz convention that it didn't upset at least most white and a lot of black audiences, because, of course, most of the minstrel troupes after the war were black performers wearing the same awful minstrel makeup as the white performers had, because that was the convention. But today, I mean, we're better people for it. We just, it's very difficult to get past that. There's one performance, though, that I think would really test anybody's mettle on this, and especially if you think that, you know, the whole idea is just too offensive for words. And that's, again, it's a Crosby. Crosby is terrible in blackface, incidentally. I hate when he did it. But he did a movie called If I Had My Way. And one of the reasons he did it with David Butler, the director, is they were both show business fanatics, and they grew up hanging out in vaudeville and minstrel houses. And they were talking about, there were four or five performers who were still alive that they loved as kids who had never been in front of a camera. So that was the excuse for doing this film. And the highlight of the film is Eddie Leonard, who was a blackface performer from the 1890s, this was right before he died, does Ida. And it is such a spellbinding performance that no matter how put off you may be by the makeup, which is actually not that offensive the way he did it, you cannot, I mean, he does moonwalks. He does all these steps that you would think came 50 years later.
Uh-huh.
He's absolutely spellbinding. That's the difference. But, you know, with Jolson, if you just listen to some of the later Decca recordings, or if you listen to the radio duets, especially the ones with Crosby, I think he's charming and enchanting and sometimes very funny. It's hard to get past the conventions he came out of.
The duet that Bing and Al recorded of Whispering on one of their 8 or 9 programs they did together,
yeah,
is just outstanding. One of their great records.
It is, and they're very funny on things like Alexander's Ragtime Band or The Spaniard Who Blighted My Life. I mean, you can Bing idolized.
That's Jolson. A Decca recording they made, right?
That's right. Bing, his first taste of show business really was pulling the ropes on the curtains at the theater in Spokane when he was 11 or 12, and Jolson came through town. Jolson was touring the country, and he got one look at Jolson. And this, again, is one of the things that I love about the entertainment business. I mean, Bing is from the poor side of the tracks, Irish Catholic. They used to call the Little Vatican. I mean, they had nicknames like that for this community he lived in. And here comes this Jew from New York who could not be more different in his approach to music and his and everything in his background. And all of that disappears. It just completely disappears. And the same thing happened in those days when you listen to recordings. Crosby in Spokane and Louis Armstrong in New Orleans, both growing up exactly at the same time, getting hold of record players around the same time, and they listened to everything. You know, Bing is listening to Irish tenors and jazz and marching bands and dance bands, and Louis is listening to the same stuff. And they didn't come to it with any of the cultural prejudices that we have now. They both loved Irish tenors. You know,
But Jolson, if you had talent,
or you didn't have talent.
Yeah. Well, Jolson loved that kind of stuff, too. Well, I guess you could argue that since Jolson was really the first popular vocalist in America of renown,
mm-hmm.
and he influenced everybody, including Bing Crosby, and then Bing influenced everybody, especially Frank Sinatra, that really all performers since Al Jolson were, whether they know it or not, deeply influenced by him.
Either because they learned something from him, or because they were working in a kind of direct opposition. Now, I would say Judy Garland is maybe the last really great Jolson-style performer.
Mm-hmm.
You have very little influence of the whole jazz world that was going on in her work. That's not what she's about. She's about really belting and emoting from the heart, and that's her gift. Without Jolson, it's impossible to imagine Garland. Bing, on the other hand, seems to me one of the reasons he was so successful is because he was the anti-Jolson to the degree that he didn't shout. I mean, I think it was Alistair Cook, who was a commentator in England in as far back as the 30s, late 20s maybe, who said that others, Jolson's generation sang at you, Bing sang to you. And, you know, he was a baritone, he lowered the temperature, he made you hear the lyrics, he could do more mature kinds of lyrics, but yet, as I say in the first volume, when you analyze those records he made with Whiteman, boy, you do hear the Jolson influence. I mean, you can hear him doing certain pronunciations and the way he does a tag end of phrases, and you know that he listened to those records as well, even while he's developing this very original and almost antithetical style.
Well, Gary Giddens, you love old music, and you love old, I don't mean the word old to be derogatory, but vintage music, let's say, and vintage mm-hmm. movies. Is there anything in the 21st century that you like? Do you ever?
Oh yeah, I think this is a great period for jazz. I'm not really functioning as a jazz critic anymore. I just published a book last year, A History of Jazz, which is I'm very proud of. I did it with Scott DeVoe. And I'm still listening. I think this is a great period. I'm just resentful as hell that it's not on radio, it's not on television, it's not commercially available to most people. But I can tell you that in New York, the club scene is very active. The places are filled every night. And there are so many great gifted young musicians. I was thrilled last week to see that Jason Moran, one of my favorite young piano players in his early 30s, won a MacArthur Grant. And there are a lot of musicians like that. And I also think this is, we don't live in a film culture in the way where everybody goes to the movies once or twice a week. But I've been seeing some great movies. In fact, if there are any gamblers in your audience who want to take early bets on who's going to win the Academy Award,
yes.
I will clue you in. It's going to Colin Firth is going to win for The King's Speech, and The King's Speech may very well win for Best Picture. This is a real crowd pleaser and an absolutely enthralling performance by Colin Firth. This film's going to be a big hit. It's going to open in November. And another film that I deeply love, I've seen it twice now, but it hasn't found a distributor yet, is an animated film by a Spanish director named Fernando Trubé, who made Calais 54. Did you see that? It was a movie, it was a sort of a documentary about Latin jazz.
Mm-hmm.
And this is an animated film, Chico and Rita, which deals with the whole post-war phenomenon of Cubans in New York working together. It's got animated versions of, Dizzy Gillespie and Charlie Parker and Nat King Cole and Thelonious Monk, as well as, Tito Puente and Chano Pozo, and it's great fun. It's just, I would have to rank it as one of the best films with a jazz theme ever made. And a very moving love story. I mean, you're in tears at the end of it. There's a 9-hour film about the terrorist Carlo that's, rough on your backbone,
yeah.
But it's an amazing thing to watch. There's a lot of great filmmaking going on. It's just most of it, in my judgment, is not coming out of Hollywood. And there aren't as many films. And a lot of the genres that made movies so appealing for so many decades have just, disappeared. I'm writing an article now, actually, for a magazine about service comedies, which is a genre that
right.
young people have never even heard of. I mean, you can't have service comedies when you no longer have a draft, because what they're really about is the guys who got drafted, trying to put one over on the officers. That's the basic idea.
Yeah.
And,
there were tons of them. Everybody did.
Tons them. Of them. That's right. And one of the great television shows of all time, Sergeant Bilko, was totally a service comedy.
Kansas, but it's so New York. It's so obviously made in New York. It's unbelievable.
Right. And westerns have disappeared and musicals. I mean, when the musical that is occasionally made or the Western is occasionally made is an exception, but it's, we don't live in a world in which they're just part of our lives.
Also, it seems that when we're looking at the era that you're writing about in Warning Shadows, that the movies that were popular were also the movies that were critical successes, whereas the movies that you've all just mentioned a few minutes ago, none of them are the popular movies like, I don't know, Inception or, you know, the movies that draw huge dollars.
Oh, believe me, The King's Speech will make money.
Yeah?
It's going to be a big hit. I mean, this is the... I think this is a film that a lot of people, especially, you know, adults, have been waiting for. This is a film that people will go out to see. But you're right. There are not a lot of films like that anymore. And most, you know, the films that you can bank on are the comic strip movies, the science fiction, the franchise movies with the same character comes back all the time. And you know, it's a different. That's the Hollywood aesthetic right now. But you really should keep your eyes open for what's coming out of Europe. And especially countries that never really had great film, studios. And, I mean, there were interesting films coming out of Iran now. And almost all the Asian countries are producing interesting films. And there's a lot of good independent films in America. I think that, if you pick and choose, you can see there's quite a lot of good movies to see. I just mentioned Colin Firth. I wonder if people in your audience saw A Single Man. Did you see that?
Yes, that was an excellent film.
Terrific film. I mean, very faithfully based on Christopher Isherwood's novel, which could never have been filmed in the 60s when it was written. But you know, really quite a remarkable piece of work. So, yeah, there are a lot of great artists working in movies. I love practically everything Clint Eastwood does, especially in recent years. I thought Million Dollar Baby was an extraordinary picture.
Gran Torino.
Gran Torino's terrific film. I loved his two World War II films. So, you know, it's not dead, but then one of the themes of my work, certainly in Warning Shadows and a lot of the jazz books, is that it's not dead if it's available to you. I mean, you know, you don't have to watch something just because it's new. These things are available now on DVD, turn to classic movies. There, you know, not everything's available, but a great deal is, and it's certainly in music. There's probably more recordings available than ever before, despite the fact that the recording industry is in free fall. So you know, you can pick and choose, just as we do in literature. I mean, you may love contemporary writers, or you may be very happy with Dickens and Tolstoy. But
and Hammett.
Yeah. Exactly. So, you know, these are cultural decisions we make. I wonder at people who say, you know, literature is dead or cinema is dead or music is, jazz is dead, simply because they're not paying attention anymore. If you pay attention, it's not that they're dead, nor can they die. It's that the culture is no longer riveted by them in the way that it once was, when a new book by a famous writer was something everybody talked about. We don't live in that world anymore.
I guess because there's just so much.
That's part of it. Yeah, I think that's a lot of it. It's confusing. It's an issue that I think a lot of people wonder about, but nobody's really taken on, and it would make a very interesting book. But, you know, more people now get a university or a college education than ever before. Especially, this change is especially strong with women. When I was coming out of high school, most of the boys that I went to school with had to go to college. Most of the girls, it was extremely, some of them were just going to go out and get married. Some of them went to college, but it wasn't something that you had to do. I mean, my daughter had no choice. She was going to college. And that's the way it is, I think, pretty much down the line right now. Genders are equal. So why is it that if there's more college-educated people than ever before, there is a less, you know, a decline in interest in the arts?
I think that partially has to do with beginning in elementary education and secondary education, that now the emphasis is on things that can be measured by standardized tests, which precludes the arts to a large extent.
That's right. That's one thing. Another thing I've noticed watching my daughter's education, is that they give you so much homework that discretionary reading is almost impossible. Whereas, I don't know, when I was growing up, it was the books we read out of class that we were always talking about. Frequently, we read them out of class because you weren't allowed to bring them into class, things like Catcher in the Rye, which, you know, my daughter got as a homework assignment when she was 14. I mean, things have changed. You know, I would say to my daughter, you know, you're going to love this book. Read this. And she'd say, Dad, are you crazy? I've got to read 800 pages of this, 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 and this, and write two papers. And, you know, I don't know if that's the way education should be going, but It is a puzzlement to me, and it is a puzzlement to me also that there doesn't seem to be a standard cultural base that we can all agree on. I'm always amazed. I teach at the Graduate Center at the City University of New York, and I'm always amazed, very smart students who have not read Homer. And, you know, I said, first of all, Homer's the most entertaining writer there is on Earth, and second, he is the foundation of the civilization you live in. You know, stop whatever you're doing and read the Iliad, and for dessert, the Odyssey. But you know, there was a period when you got out of school, no matter what you majored in, there were certain books that everybody had read, certain films everybody had seen, certain pieces of music that everybody knew, and they formed a kind of a bond, and that seems to have dissipated.
Well, I never read the Bible, but I did see the movie.
Yeah, me too. It was a terrible movie. I love John Huston, but that may be the worst film he ever made.
Gary Gidden's new book is called Warning Shadows, Home Alone with Classic Cinema, and it's got a great picture of Dan Duryea in a giant suit on the front. It's a wonderful book, and there's some movies to talk about. And Gary Giddens, you and I have so much to talk about. Will you come back and be a guest again on From the Bookshelf?
Oh, absolutely. Be happy to.
Well, that closes the book on this week's edition of From the Bookshelf, and I hope you enjoyed the program and that you'll come back and join us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at KUSP.org or find us on Facebook and iTunes. I want to thank our From the Bookshelf staff, the lovely and talented Miss Breanne Beal, for all of her hard work. Thank you so much, Breanne. And I want to thank our guest, Gary Giddens, his new book, Warning Shadows, Home Alone with Classic Cinema. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.